accession number 18209, reel 3.
Major Lee Tart, reel 3.
I was very weak too, and I had to be carried, in fact, which the Gurkhas did, and then the Japs had the one or two skirmishes with the Japs, and they put me down under a bush and dealt with the situation and then picked me up again. So I was really owe my life to them. Of course, they could easily have dumped me if they didn't want to. Of course, they would never have done so. And eventually got back to the battalion, and the doctor did what he could with sulfanamide powder, I think, at the time. I don't think penicillin had been invented, or certainly hadn't got to us there. And the battalion then moved on, leaving me with my orderly and a few other chaps who as a sort of escort. And my orderly built me a little hut out of bamboo and a bed, and he gave me morphine injections and fed me, did his best. He actually made a bedpan out of a kerosene tin, and his service to me was quite exceptional and wonderful. The few men who were with us went out to the rice fields, and they made a little landing strip there, and somehow I think the battalion must have sent a message saying that I was there, and one of these American light planes, L-5s I think they were called, came in one morning, and they loaded me into this plane, and it took off in this little strip and flew me some distance, I don't know how far, to an American base somewhere near Mogong up that way, where I was transferred to a Dakota and flown to an advanced hospital called Panatola, I think it was, in Assam. And the following day had thing fixed up properly and plaster and everything. And I was then out of commission, as it were, for almost a year, and eventually went home. And
did you make a full recovery from the wound?
Well, not really. I still doesn't work very well. I managed to get myself made Category B, which was good enough to get back again to the battalion. And after a year, I got back to Dehradun, our depot, and was a training battalion commander for a bit. And then got out to the battalion that was in Java, actually, at the time, and where they were fighting the Indonesian insurgents who were trying to take over the whole country. Egged on by the Japs, really. And we spent several months there holding a ring defense outside Surabaya. One of the most episodes which one remembers most was Indonesians, after the Japs surrendered, the Indonesians took all the Jap internees out of Japanese internment camps around Surabaya and put them into the main jail in Surabaya called Kali Sasok Jail. And they separated the women and the men in this jail. And our orders were to get them out of this jail. And the warders and Indonesian insurgent people were shooting whenever the particular company doing the job got near. And it was decided to try and bash the jail door open. And an armoured car was driven at this door at high speed. But unfortunately, it was one of these doors which opened this way, not that way.
And of course, it opened across.
And of course, the armoured car just bounced off and made the door unopenable anyhow. So it was decided to blow a hole in the wall with what's known as a Bangalore torpedo, which was a piece of piping full of explosive. And a hole was blown, and the Gurkhas went in into this hole and found another wall inside with a gap of about 2 feet between the two walls. And they went down between the walls to the towards the gate and came out into the main bit of the jail. And there were three warders there who started firing at the Gurkhas with pistols. And the Gurkhas chased them into what turned out to be the mortuary of the jail. And when the Gurkhas got to the mortuary, there were three corpses lying on slabs with shrouds over them. And one of the Gurkhas, being rightly suspicious, poked one of these corpses with a bayonet, and all three of them jumped up and ran further into the jail with Gurkhas pursuing them and were suitably dealt with. And then these unfortunate Dutch were let out of the cells. And they'd been, as I said, they'd been segregated, the men and the women, and husbands didn't know whether wives were still alive and vice versa. So you can imagine the scenes of emotion that took place when they mixed together again, looking for each other. And of course, some of them didn't find what they hoped. A terrible scene, really. I wasn't there, but I heard about this. And they came out. They were got out through the hole in the wall, actually, and sent down to places of safety. And the company commander who did this operation said he never had to shake so many hands so often for so long. And he was very moved by the whole business. And so were the Gurkhas, I must say. They thought it was a terrible thing to have done, the way these Indonesians incarcerated these Dutch. And as it happened, we didn't know at the time, but one of the warders had defected and gone to the intelligence people in brigade, in divisional headquarters, and had said that the Indonesians intended to surround the jail with petrol tins and burn the whole thing down the next day. So it appeared that we only just got there in time.
This was in Surabaya.
Surabaya. And as a last year, 2 years ago, I was at a school concert, and sitting next to me was a Dutch woman whose son was playing playing in the orchestra. And the conversation got around to, she'd been born in Java, actually. And she said, as a matter of fact, my father was rescued by the Gurkhas in Surabaya. This was just a couple of years ago. And he's always wanted to be able to thank whoever it was who let him out. And so we were able to arrange. Her father was still alive, age 80-something. And we arranged a meeting with the company commander and him a few months later, which was a strange coincidence to happen, really. And from Surabaya, we went to Malaya, and then back to Indonesia in Palembang, where we're guarding an oil field which the Indonesians were trying to wreck. Although, in fact, it was one of the things they would need themselves. It was a ridiculous situation. And I think the whole of that minor war in Indonesia after the ending of the main war was a very thankless task, really, for everybody.
You said that the Indonesians were being egged on by the Japanese?
Initially they were. The Japs gave them arms as well in Java.
What did the Gurkhas think about it?
Well, they wondered what on earth was going on. And, the war was supposed to be over, and the British were back in Malaya and Singapore, and the Dutch were supposed to be coming back to Indonesia. And the Indonesians were... So many of them behaving in a way which couldn't be justified by reasonable nationalism at all. It was just sheer banditry, and that's what we were putting up with, really, not the decent Indonesians who were wanting to take over the government from the Dutch, but these hooligans, really, who were supplied by the Japs mostly, who were just bent on doing the Dutch down. The Dutch were terribly unpopular, though, much more so than we were in Malaya. And the way the Indonesians carried on was, as I say, couldn't be justified by any reasonable means of getting self-government from the Dutch. And that was what we had to put up with, these people who were really not only trying to destroy the Dutch, but they were actually, by their actions, destroying the economy of the place they were supposed to be taking over. And one felt, to hell with them, why should we have casualties dealing with these people? I think that's what people felt.
And yet you took casualties.
Yeah, quite a lot of casualties in around Surabaya. In fact, during that siege of the jail, one British officer got shot in the, right through the mouth, and came out the back of his neck. Luckily missed everything.
Would your Gurkhas get hit by snipers?
I think that was mostly what happened in the operations on the outer ring of the defence of Surabaya, yes.
Now, perhaps we can move on to the Malayan emergency, and can you tell me how you were involved with that, please?
Yes. I'd transferred to the second Gurkhas then. Of course, the Indians had taken over my own regiment. And we were stationed in Singapore from, I think it was March 48 onwards. And in September 48, I think it was, things started to go wrong in Malaya. And first of all, we were detailed for internal security in Singapore. And then suddenly, we were told to move to South Johor. And was then with, I think, C Company commander then. And I was under command of a British battalion up in a place called Kluang. And the immediate impression I got was that it was, well, the planters, poor things, were planting rubber by day and defending their estates by night and suffering a lot of casualties and ambushed the Malayan police seemed to be very bad at getting any intelligence about what was going on. I don't suppose it was their fault, because the Chinese, the rural Chinese in Malaya, were completely intimidated by the so-called bandits, and they weren't prepared to give information about what the bandits were doing. So it was extremely difficult for the police to get any information at all about what was going on. And I found that I got up there one afternoon and at very night, and one of the estates quite nearby was attacked by a collection of people dressed in khaki uniforms and firing around the manager's bungalow and setting fire to the coolies' quarters on the estate. And this is what went on, really. The Tamil, mostly Tamil workers, rubber tappers, were intimidated, and the couldn't find out where the bandits were, what they were doing, when they were, what they were going to do. And it was really, one rushed about responding to calls for help, but can't do much at night. And most of what was happening took place at night. And one set ambushes and things on so-called information, which usually turned out to be wrong. And the whole thing was thoroughly frustrating, I found. And one was moved about, attached to various other battalions as a company for various operations called Operation Soccer, Operation This and Operation That, based on usually dud information. And this was the start of the emergency, and it really became thoroughly stultifying, really. One couldn't get anything done at all. And then the High Commissioner Gurney was murdered by the bandits. And I think the government in London began to realise they'd got a problem on their hands. And this was after I left, actually, when Templar came. And overnight the whole situation changed completely. It was the most dynamic character. But my part in the emergency only lasted from, September 48 until about April 49.
On the sheet you've actually put July 48 to March 49.
Oh, that's so I went.
But anyway, that doesn't matter.
I went on a month's leave home, actually, at the time. Whilst I was involved in an emergency, it was early on, and as I say, I think it was hopeless situation. Was the struck me that the Malayan police didn't get the information required, and they had everyone running about on false trails, and nothing much was achieved. In fact, the situation really got worse until Templar came and started sorting things out and having these villages, all of the Chinese villages lumped together in defensive positions so that the bandits couldn't intimidate them and couldn't steal their food and get food from them.
But did you personally have any brushes with the enemy in the plantations or jungle?
Yes, we had several times we got ambushed, as it were, and killed a few people in them. We were lucky in one or two occasions. Got to camps where there were, in fact, some. In fact, Christmas 1948, we were up at Sagamet, and we had some quite good information there, and found a big camp, and quite a number of bandits were killed by my company.
Can you remember what happened on that occasion?
Yes, we had a guide who said he could take us to this camp, and he in fact did take us quite close, but he was shaking with fear and wouldn't take us any further, and so we went on and hoped for the best, and we did come into the camp actually, and the bandits rushed out. They were just cooking a meal, and they rushed out into a swamp far side of the camp, and a platoon followed them up and killed quite a few of them crossing the swamp. And of course the camp itself, we destroyed it and burnt all the huts and everything. And I was able to ask for an airstrike the next morning, where I thought these remainder of the bandits had gone in the jungle. And the RAF did some strafing with Spitfires, dropped a few small bombs and things. Whether it was any good or not, I don't know, but good for morale to see something like that happening.
Did you recover anything of use from the camp?
I think the police got some information from documents found there, who was who and who was in charge of the place. But I don't know whether it subsequently was of any use to them. I think it probably was. That area, I think, became slightly more passive for a bit. That was Christmas Day, actually, 48.
Yeah. Was that a Chinese civilian who led you?
That's right, it was, yes. Mm. And he was... Police got hold of him. That was the police officer there was a particularly good chap, Jock Neal, I remember his name. He was very good at persuading people to do things, if you know what I mean. And I think he got this information for us from somebody or other, I don't know who. That particular operation was about the only really useful thing that I did, I think. The rest was just rushing about trying to help. I had several other ambushes and no casualties.
Was that the full company that went in after that camp?
It was, yes, but the platoon in front did most of the work, actually, because difficult to move a lot of people about in the jungle there, just on one track, really. But one didn't know what was going to happen. It didn't in fact use the other two platoons at all. In fact, mostly operations when I was there were sort of platoon or even section ambushes and things like that. I don't think any ambushes were ever successful. We never had information that so-and-so was going to walk down such and such a path at such and such a time, but never actually happened somehow.
But your Gurkhas got ambushed themselves?
Yeah, twice we were, well, we say ambushed, we were going up to what we thought might have been a hideout and bumped them, and they fired off a few rounds and then ran away. That was the sort of thing, just a short skirmish, really.
Was anybody hit?
No, as it happened.
What were the Gurkhas like in the jungle?
Oh, they're first class there, and of course they'd all been in Burma too, or most of them had. And we spent a lot of time living in the jungle, actually. Used to go out and spend several days in various places hoping to come across these bandits. And in no time at all, they'd have a little camp built of bamboo and make little huts and things. They were first class at that sort of thing.
Because it wasn't their natural environment.
No, no, but
did you have illnesses?
There was some malaria, but not much. This mepocrine that we had tended to certainly suppress it. And each evening, the men were fell in and actually seen to take the pills.
I think that you had something to do with the police side.
Later on, yeah. I was asked whether I would consider leaving the army and joining colonial police to set up this Gurkha unit of paramilitary Gurkha unit in the police force. There was a paramilitary Sikh unit before the war in Singapore, but the men had mutinied during when the Japs appeared, and they weren't going to have them again. So I was attached from the Second Gurkhas to the Singapore police for a couple of months, and another officer went and recruited the men in Nepal, and I set up this unit of 150 Gurkhas. They actually started it in April 1949, and I then transferred, resigned my career.